Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Vivian, thank you very much. Now, recriminations are continuing following an Israeli airstrike on a UN-run school and de facto refugee shelter in central Gaza. 14 children and 9 women were among those killed, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. But Israel's defence forces insist it was a precise strike against Hamas militants involved in October the 7th. Now, separately, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been invited to Washington to address both houses of Congress on the 24th of July. For the very latest, we're joined by Sky News Middle East correspondent Alistair Bunkle. Alistair, thank you for joining us again. That fallout from the strike on the UN school in central Gaza, it continues today.
Yeah, it does. The overall death toll still said to be in excess of 40 people. As always, we caveat that because it's coming from the health ministries in Gaza. But the IDF have admitted carrying out the strikes. It's just that their justification is that it was a Hamas command center, and they say that they had aerial surveillance over it for a number of days. They took decision on multiple occasions not to carry out the strike because they saw civilians close by. But ultimately, they believe that it was a target, a legitimate target, because it was a Hamas command center. However many Hamas fighters they took out, they have also killed many civilians as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned this invitation which has been issued to the Israeli Prime Minister to address both houses of Congress. That will not be without controversy.
No, I mean, very controversial, highly politicised. There was a lot of negotiation that went on before this invitation was issued. Ultimately, it was issued in the names of all four major leaders of Congress, including the Democrats, including Chuck Schumer. But when Netanyahu does go to Washington in late July, it will be a very controversial moment. And a lot of Democrats in particular oppose this invitation. Now, we don't know whether or not they will boycott the speech and decide to stay away from it, because there's also talk that they're thinking about attending the speech as a way of disrupting it. Mm-hmm. But the key thing will be, what does Joe Biden do? Joe Biden, he was not a part of this invitation. It has echoes, actually, of what happened under the Obama administration, when Netanyahu went to speak despite Obama's wishes as president. Will Biden be in town even? Will he find a reason not to be in Washington to avoid an awkward diplomatic moment? Because as things stand at the moment, I think it's unlikely that Biden will invite Netanyahu to the White House as part of this.
Mm-hmm. Particularly, we don't know where we will be with this ceasefire bid, which is ongoing. It doesn't appear that it's going to be successful, but we're looking at the 24th of July for this visit, so we could be in a very different place by then.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, if there was, you know, if there's a scenario where a ceasefire was in play, and, you know, we were a few weeks into it, we'd seen many of the hostages being released, Israeli forces had withdrawn from parts of Gaza, you know, we might be in a very different political diplomatic situation by then, in which case it might be that Biden, as part of efforts to extend the ceasefire, make it permanent, etc., it might be then that he does set up and arrange a meeting with Netanyahu as part of that, as, you know, reaching out a hand of friendship, because the two have not been particularly friendly over the last few months. Mm-hmm. But as things stand right now, I have to say, the prospect of a ceasefire, of a hostage deal, is not looking good.
Yes. What is the latest on that?
Well, ultimately, we're still waiting to hear back from Hamas. We're still waiting to hear what Hamas's official position is. And I think that's largely down to a delay emanating from Gaza and from the leadership in Gaza. Both, you know, in Israel, there have been developments. Both the ultra-Orthodox parties within the Israeli coalition, they've come out this week and say they support a deal, which is actually quite significant, because that dilutes the opposition of the far right, who have come out and said that they don't support a deal. So that gives Netanyahu a bit more power if he wants to push forward with this deal. The US apparently are putting pressure on the Qataris to expel Hamas if Hamas did not agree to a deal. Now, Hamas have said, you know, that's not going to happen, but if it did, it will have no effect because the decision lies in Gaza. But it looks like the Americans are trying to put pressure on all sides in a big way to agree this deal. And one of those things is saying to Hamas, if you're not going to agree to it, then we want you to get out of Qatar.
Yeah, I mean, all of this thing, going back to the Americans and the invitation to address both houses of Congress, I just see that the New York Times reporting that they have video, analysed video, showing that the strike on that UNRWA school, in that strike, there was a bomb which appears to be US made. And they have video of that on their website now. And I suppose really that is, it shows, it demonstrates just how complex all of this is.
Yeah. So also, if we go back to that strike on a refugee camp near Rafah a couple of weeks ago, which killed many civilians, women and children as well. That also was found to have been caused by US-provided munitions. Now, what the Israelis will say, and the Americans will probably back them up on this if they're minded to do so, is that these were very small bombs. They had very little explosive ordnance on them, and therefore they were precise, as opposed to the massive 2,000-pound bombs that had been used previously in the war. And so the Israelis would probably argue that they're being far more judicious in their targeting and what they're using, which might or might not satisfy the Americans. But again, it does show, as you say, it shows how linked the Americans are to this war, even if they're not fighting it themselves. You know, they have provided a lot of the weaponry that is being used. And at the same time, they're trying to put pressure on the Israelis to bring this war to an end.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, really, when we look at what has happened over the last 6 or 7 months, that the war has been contained to Gaza and that it hasn't spread further afield. I know we have had this conversation about Hezbollah in the past. How has that been done?
Well, in respect to Hezbollah and what's going on in the north, for the most part, the two sides, Hezbollah and the Israelis, have been firing at each other in a reasonably limited manner. And what I mean by that is that Hezbollah have been targeting Israel at short range, and not exclusively by any means, but a lot of their attempts, if they're trying to inflict damage, it's been at military installations as opposed to civilian installations. That has started to change in the last few weeks. Actually, I just did some quick fact-checking before speaking to you. In January, Hezbollah fired 334 missiles over the border. February, 534. April and March, it was around about 750. And in May, it was in excess of 1,000. So that shows you how over the last few weeks, it's really escalated. And it's now escalated to a point where people wonder if it's getting out of control and whether or not it's going to force the Israelis to do something. And when I say something, that would probably be a land incursion of some description.
Mm-hmm. And there's an investigation by Human Rights Watch which found white phosphorus used in at least 17 locations, Alistair, in Lebanon. Now, white phosphorus, it does have some legitimate uses in battle. It is not supposed to be used, though, or deployed in civilian areas. So what have you been hearing about this?
Yeah, so it's the white phosphorus, which I've seen being used in conflict zones around the world, is a legitimate weapon or a legitimate military weapon, but only in certain circumstances, not to be used. It breaches international law if it's used against a civilian population, because it can be very, very dangerous. It's kind of, it's white, yellow in color. It's kind of got an odor, a bit like garlic. But what it does is it spontaneously ignites and it keeps on burning for a very, very long time. Now, for militaries, the advantage in it is that it produces a dense white smoke. It also produces illumination at night. So it can be used under international law in open areas against other militaries in order to provide a smoke screen or light. But as soon as you use it in civilian areas, it can burn right through to the bone. It can cause severe respiratory problems. It's very, very nasty. And Human Rights Watch say that they've documented use of it in southern Lebanon. They say that a number of people, I think about 170, have reportedly been treated for the effects of white phosphorus. Now, the IDF and the Israeli military say that's absolutely categorically not true. They've only used it in accordance with international law. But again, it shows how complicated these things become in a battlefield, whether that battlefield is southern Lebanon or Gaza. These are densely populated areas anyway, so using something like white phosphorus is pretty complicated.
Alistair, thank you once again for speaking to us. Alistair Bunkle there, Sky News Middle East correspondent. Now, author Kieran Coote will be here next to talk about his poignant new memoir that recalls his time spent caring for his mother after her dementia diagnosis. That's after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.